G'day everybody, my name is Glenn Hill.
Jacob Meyer.
Welcome to Tactical Tennis Podcast. Today we're not going to talk about Roger Federer, at least not at first.
Well, now you're a liar, but that's okay. So let's talk about, first of all, I'm not quite sure how to pronounce this guy's name.
Shapovalov.
Even though I've always called him Shapovalov. I need to ask him.
He's you should nice ask kid. Him. I'm going to call him Shapovalov.
I'm going to ask him. But, you know, he just like made the semifinals. He's supposed to play Vancouver this week. I don't know if he's going to go play. I'm recording here from the hotel lobby in Cincinnati. I don't know if I'm going to see him before the U.S. Open, so we'll have to wait a couple of weeks before I can figure out his name.
Right. Well, it doesn't matter. No matter what his name actually is, what he tells you, I'm calling him Shapovalov.
Okay. That's an interesting approach to that. I like it. I'll make sure to mention that to him.
Please do. So, what a run, though. I mean, he comes into the tournament, and I think he had, what, 3 ATP-level wins in his entire career up until this point?
That's a good stat. I didn't pull that stat. I know that I've been watching him for a while. He is very good.
Yeah, the kid's got talent. There's no doubt about that. But let's talk a little bit about his game then, and you know, maybe project forward, like what we see him kind of being capable of over the next little while, and maybe well past that too. Obviously, left-handed player.
Canadian teenager, one-handed backhand. What else?
Well, when you look at him play, what are things that stand out to you about him?
He hits the ball hard. And that might sound kind of funny, but he swings free. Actually, like some people talk about, like people who, I mean, you know how commentators and fans can get when we see young guys come onto the circuit, get really, really excited and maybe embellish and get overexcited. But they're talking big stuff about his one-handed backhand. I love one-handed backhands. I'd love to see you do a breakdown of his stroke. I think it's going to continue to change a little bit over the next 4 or 5 years, especially.
Sure.
But what really stands out about it is that he pretty much lets it fly. I mean, he is actually not very good at hitting what I would call like half speed or moderated backhands, or even really just tennis shots in
anything.
General.
Yeah, I mean, he's not managing that side in any sense of the word. I mean, he's letting it rip.
He's letting it rip. And so I think that's what we see that looks so beautiful, is because it's a big full stroke. He pulls the shoulder back, and I don't think his shoulder movement is perfect by any means, but boy, oh boy, he turns his hips and lets it fly. And that's a great way to play. So that's what really stands out, is that when the guy gets nervous, he hits, like he goes for it. So he tries to win matches. I mean, he's not out there waiting for guys to lose. He's not waiting for someone to miss. He's not trying not to disappoint people or trying not to make mistakes. He is trying to beat you.
He's taking it to you. So I look at his game, and I mean, to me, it's a technically very sound game. I mean, his service motion's pretty solid and it's clean. His forehand's the same. His backhand's the same. I mean, like, this guy doesn't have a lot of technical issues.
Volleys well too. He can play dubs.
Yeah, the big question to me is just going to be, one of the things that separates those truly great players from the players in the tier below that, and I guess I should say tiers plural below that, is their ability to risk manage, to manage those fine margins. I mean, the difference between being a Roger Federer, you know, who's winning 55, 56% of his points in a match and as his career average, right? So a career average over a tournament. Well, it is, but the funny thing is, like, the difference between being a Roger Federer and being a David Ferrer, especially if we look at David Ferrer, you know, a couple of years ago before he declined, is really only 2 or 3%. You know, like a Roger Federer is winning 55% career points, and a David Ferrer is winning like 52.
And, or something?
Yeah, that doesn't. I'm ballparking, and it's been a little while since I looked at this, but I spent a little time looking at these stats, a year or two ago, and that's not a big margin. That's not a huge difference. You know, when the average person probably hears that probably doesn't seem like the difference between, you know, the 19 Grand Slam winner, greatest player of all time, and a guy who was really good and kind of the gatekeeper to the top four, but will never go into the Hall of Fame. Right. I mean, you think 2 or 3% shouldn't.
Wait, who's not going to go into the Hall of Fame?
Perez not going to the Hall of Fame.
He might, man.
He's not.
He
was
top five for like a long time.
Yes, he was.
I think he's going to get some votes because remember, he's a part of this. I mean, there's like a generational gap here. So, you know, there's only a few guys that won slams. I don't know. It's going to be interesting. He'll be one of the few guys. Well, actually, I have no idea how many guys are in the Hall of Fame without winning a slam.
As players, I don't think there's one.
Really?
As players, I don't believe there's a single. I could be wrong, and listeners, if I'm wrong about this, I'm sure somebody out there would know. Please do email and let us know. But my belief is right now that there are obviously some people who have got into the Tennis Hall of Fame for other contributions to tennis, be it coaching or promotion or whatever. But there's no current, like there's no players who got into the Hall of Fame because of their playing that never won a single slam. I mean, there was talk about whether or not, you know, Roddick should get in with his one. That was a big question for a while. Well, there are people that are unhappy that Roddick.
No, there's got to be because there's somebody. Guys have gotten in for Davis Cup. Like Baghdatis will probably get in for having like the most Davis Cup wins, even though it's not at the highest level in the world group.
I'm dubious about that.
I think the way that these things get voted sometimes can be funny, but this is besides the point. The point is that it's a very very small margin between being someone who we look at as not a Grand Slam champion and essentially not one of the elite tennis players, and then someone who, like Ferrer, is tremendously respected by all the players. He's been a top 10 player for most of his career. He is a heck of a player, but he's not in that same category as the guys that have won slams.
No, he's not. And the difference statistically is actually very small. So the point is this. The difference between being a Roger Federer and being a David Ferrer is finding a way to win an extra 2 or 3% of your points played per match over an extended period of time, which, right, again, isn't really very much. A lot of that just comes down to decisions. And one of the things that I'm very curious to see about Shapovalov is whether or not he can – I mean, right now he's going out there and – you know, he moves well, don't get me wrong, but he's not risk managing a whole lot. And look, and this is a great, like, he just had a great run, obviously. Like, he just had a great run. And that's fantastic for him, right? But let's also keep in mind that this is the only time that he's really made a run in any professional, like, ATP level event. If we look earlier in the year, I mean, lost first round at Wimbledon, lost first round at qualifying at the French. The guy's got talent.
He's winning challengers. He works hard. I fight the talent thing because he's out there. Like he actually has a mindset to me that's similar to a Nick Kyrgios, where he's going for it, but he's not playing ridiculous, like sometimes foolish tennis like Kyrgios. Like he's not throwing it in terms of he's not just like ripping it and like, oh, I hope it goes in, and you know, if I lose then whatever. Like he's fighting to be aggressive.
Yes.
And he's winning consistently at the ATP level, where he's not winning ATP tournaments consistently, but I mean he's still like I want to say like a year and a half, maybe a little bit more younger than Zverev. I mean, he's only a little bit behind where Zverev was at this point in time.
Right. Well, I feel like Zverev was winning more matches at the ATP level a year ago. I could be wrong about that.
That's like saying, you know, wait 6 months and let's see if Dennis is winning first round matches consistently at the ATP level. I mean, that wouldn't surprise me at all.
Right. No, in a year, if he's winning. Yeah, I mean, I could see that happening in a year. That's probably reasonable. But I just think, like, if we look at Zverev in the same timeline, I think Zverev was, you know, being more consistent, having better results. But, you know, setting that aside for a second, you know, coming back to what I was saying, the big question to me is, can he improve the decision-making process, moderate and govern some of the aggression to play in a way that'll let him get more consistent results?
I don't – I mean, I love the aggression. there's no problem with the aggression. I think the problem is that I don't think he understands patterns quite well enough. I don't think he understands how to influence his opponent.
Right, that's what I'm talking about. You know, finding ways to improve his margins.
Yeah.
Right. That's what I'm talking about.
I almost hate to talk about this because I really do like Dennis. He's been, I mean, he's nice to all the guys around too. Or like he seems like a really good guy. He had some really unfortunate circumstances in Davis Cup, and this is the same young Canadian that got upset and cracked the ball into the stands, except for it ran into
the stands. Are we calling chair umpires stands now? Because
no, I'm saying
that's where he cracked the ball.
He was aiming for the stands. It just happened to run into someone's eye socket before it got there.
Yes.
And this, I mean, this is a huge deal. Like, this should never happen. It's a really big deal. Now, here's my concern. My concern isn't that it happened in the first place. It was an accident. He obviously was not aiming for anyone. No question about that. My concern is that I don't think that he realizes how hard he needed to work to take care of his, of how he is perceived after that incident. I mean, he pretty much just was like, well, it was an accident. I'm a nice guy. I'm going to keep doing, you know, things the way I do them. So, like, he, you know, it's not the last time that he's skied a ball out of the stands. I'm sure he's more careful now. I think he probably hits it straight up instead of anywhere near people. But that, to me, is just not good enough. And so that, I look at that and I see, you know, I wonder what's between the ears here. I wonder if this guy really is going to figure out how to train like a champion and take that aggression that he has and be able to turn it into something that's really remarkable. If we remember Fed, I mean, when Fed was that age, he was serving volleying. He was ultra aggressive. He didn't play long rallies. He played lots of, frankly, silly shots. You know, Fed is, we think of Fed differently. We don't think of him as 17-year-old, 18-year-old Federer. Like, obviously become pretty smart.
Right. I'm gonna cut in here because I think that you're reading a little too much. I mean, look, the ball to the eye socket incident was obviously not a great event in the timeline of Shapovalov's life. it was very regrettable. Like, we all could wish that didn't happen. But
yeah.
I think it's unfair to turn that into a bigger question about whether or not he understands how much work is involved. I think it was just a thing that happened.
Yeah, he understands the work, but it's like, I feel like, look, that's a huge event. That should be like an epiphany. That should be like a life-changing thing. And it still probably can be. But
I
also
feel like, you know, that it isn't. I mean, look at what he's done in the time since. I mean, look at the run he just had. Maybe it was an epiphany moment.
Yeah. Maybe. I mean, I think he was on track to do this already. I mean, he was already playing Davis Cup for Canada. Like,
he'd won like two or three main draw ATP event matches ever. You know, I think, you know, saying that he was on track to make a run to the semis of the Rogers Cup is...
I'm not saying that he was on track to run the semis. I mean, look, he surprised me by becoming... I mean, he's the youngest Masters 1000 semifinalist of all time. Like, I did not predict that he was going to make the semis. Let's be real here, okay?
Yeah, okay.
And he surprised me with that. But he didn't surprise me with the tennis that he played. The level's been there. I mean, he beat Kyrgios in Toronto last year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not like he had a nice win over a guy that was ranked 70 and didn't, you know, do a scouting report and his homework. Like, he went out there on the big stage, center court, prime time, and beat Nick Kyrgios while Nick was playing fairly well. I think Nick was a little bit surprised that the kid wasn't as intimidated and that he kept swinging away. But I mean, we've been looking at this guy for a long time. He's got the game physically. You're dead on. I think it's going to come down to how he manages the game and what kind of decisions he makes, what patterns he plays, and how he really puts together what we think of really as his tactical tennis game.
Right.
As opposed to, like, how he hits the ball. Like, he hits the ball good enough that he can beat anybody.
Yeah, so looking forward, you know, if we look forward over the next year or two, I mean, I would expect over the next year that he's going to continue to have very patchy results. I would hope that the outcomes this week for him give him a sense of confidence that will maybe kind of up his level a little bit. You know, certainly now he can feel like, oh, I belong to a degree, rightly or wrongly. I mean, I think that the win over Nadal and backing it up, you know, it wasn't just the win over Nadal. I mean, it's the fact that,
Backing it up.
yeah, backing it up. Like, he won over Nadal, but then he continued to do good things for the rest of the tournament. So there's that. Because, I mean, look, he took out Del Potro first, then Nadal, and then Manorino's still a good win, and then he pushed Zverev. So, but we're still going to expect to see a lot of up and down from him, you know? I mean, this is this year, in the same year, he's lost in the first round of challenges, and then also made the semifinals of a Masters event. So we're going to see some up down from the guy.
To be fair, I mean, I think Manorino's lost in the first round of challengers too. I mean, the challengers are, you know, are good, but the guy's going to be top 70 after this week. So he's relied on wild cards. Like, all of his ATP matches so far have been wild cards.
Right.
Well, besides the slams. But now, I mean, he's going to basically be able to play a full ATP schedule. So we're going to find out really quickly. I mean, I think he's going to stay in the top 100.
Yeah, I would expect that too. I mean, I think he'll finish the year top 100 for sure. And yeah, he'll win some first rounds here and there. I mean, I think he can obviously string together multiple wins. I just wouldn't, you know, I would just urge everybody to not get too carried away yet. I think that it's going to take a little while for him to settle in. I mean, there's a little bit. I mean, we've seen this on the women's tour recently with some players, but, you know, like, somebody breaks onto the scene, has a great tournament or two, and everyone gets very excited. But, you know, once people start paying attention and they start, you know, figuring out a little bit better how to beat you, you know, you got some work to do. And I mean, look, he's 18. He's got some physical development to still happen. He's got a lot of work to do to really figure out the patterns and get the consistency and really get the approach down, because it's the ATP is a different world than the Challenger circuit in terms of the environment and the types of places you're playing and just everything that's going on. And that'll take some time for him to kind of settle in and figure out what really works for him and what doesn't.
Yeah, well, at his current ranking, he's going to be playing mostly a 250 schedule. He's still going to sprinkle some challengers in there for sure, unless they just feel like he's just too good for challengers and he doesn't want to play those. He's won a couple. I think he's won two of them. He wins a lot in Canada. The thing that really I'm going to be looking at is how his body holds up. I feel like he may end up having some injury issues, and knock on wood, he doesn't. But the level of strength and overall fitness that you have to play consistently at that top 50 level, which is, you know, what he did this last week, that's pretty darn hard for an 18-year-old to have.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's a physically very demanding thing, and he doesn't have, you know, the years of conditioning and preparation that a lot of these other guys do. And also, coming back to that point, like, he doesn't have it all figured out yet. It's not, obviously, it's not just the can I train enough. It's all the other things that surround it as well. Managing your schedule, your travel, all those other things are important.
Yeah, he's got some good people around him. I think, I mean, from what I know, he's not doing the same work that, say, like Sasha Zverev, who's, like we said, about a year and a half older than Dennis. He went out and hired Andy Murray's strength coach 3, 4 years ago. So, I mean, he worked with him since he was 16 years old. He got strong. Zverev is very strong. He's stronger than Dennis. There's no doubt about that. And it hasn't been an accident. They've worked for it.
Right.
Dennis hasn't done that same work in the gym. He works. I'm not saying he doesn't work, but he's not like he's not one of those guys that blows you away where you're going, wow, he is training like a top 10 pro. He's not there yet. So I think that even if his tennis potentially could be there, he's playing catch up now with the rest of the stuff that you have to put together in order to be a top player.
Oh, absolutely.
It's
Absolutely.
going to take some time.
Right, so let's talk a little bit about the final, which just finished a short while ago here. A little bit of a surprise result. Federer loses his third match of the entire year, and the first match this year he's lost where he didn't actually hold match points. And
So do
Alexander, or Sasha Zverev, takes the tournament.
yeah, so Zverev wins huge title. I mean, he's sure. I remember earlier in the year we were talking about whether or not Zverev was going to make London. Sure looks like he's going to make London now.
Yeah, I think there's no doubt about that, especially, you know, when you take Djokovic's ending of the, you know, premature ending of the season, and now we've got Murray taking some big rests, taking you know, a fair number of tournaments off. I mean, that's certainly changed the landscape. I predicted he was going to sit just outside of at the end of the year, and obviously that's not going to end up being right.
I predicted that he was just going to sneak in as the one of the last guys, and that looks like it's not right either.
Yeah, well, you know, but this is, to be fair, this is one of these things where it's interesting, but when you get a Djokovic and a Murray not playing so much, that changes the dynamic in a very significant way, because, you know, now you're talking about, instead of having to break through one of the big four like consistently, if not two or three of the big four consistently every tournament in order to get this result, you know, Zverev only had to beat an injured Federer, and right. You know, he didn't have to play Nadal, he didn't have to play Wawrinka, he didn't have to play Murray, he didn't have to play Djokovic. I mean, the draw opens up a lot. You know, Zverev is good, and he's going to win his share of matches against, you know, your Dimitrovs and Queries and Berdichs and Nishikoris, in a way that, you know, he's not going to have quite as many positive results against the big four. So, you know, there's a point where I think when we made those predictions, obviously we didn't know that Djokovic was going to just mothball his season, didn't know how many tournaments Murray was going to miss in the hard court season, and that really changes that a lot, opens up a lot of opportunities. But I think he's on track right now. He's number four in the race. I'm not sure, actually. I'm just looking at the ATP's website right now. That's as of a week or like 5 days ago, he was number four in the race.
Yeah.
And so this should bump him ahead of Thiem at the end of this. And Federer.
He's number three now.
Yeah. So
he's like 800 points ahead of Thiem now. So
yeah, he'll be solidly ahead of Thiem. And then Federer will be, what, 50 or 100 points behind Nadal? Not very many. 40. Yeah. So. You know, the race is certainly interesting, but so Zverev is a shoe-in now for the end of the year tournament. I mean, as is Thiem, and then you know, Wawrinka's. It'll be interesting to see what happens with the rest of them as the next, you know, months shake out. Djokovic out, obviously. Murray's sitting at 8 in the race.
Dimitrov sitting at 9. He's got which really is 8 with Novak out for the rest of the year. So.
Yeah, and the lead Murray has over him isn't significant. And Murray's obviously not going to be playing quite as much, or as hasn't been. How about
Sam Querrey coming out of nowhere? Sam Querrey has a good U.S. Open. He's going to make London.
That's crazy. I mean, I believe it. It's just it's a little crazy to think about, isn't it?
Yeah. So anyway,
come back to the match. Yeah, let's talk about this final here for a while. So Federer, obviously, not great news for Federer fans in that he. Clearly, I don't know if it's an injury where he came in a little bit injured and then it aggravated, or if he actually actively hurt himself during the match. We're still waiting to find out the word on that. But that he was injured is quite obvious. Anybody who watched probably would have noticed the changes in his service motion. And if you didn't, no worries. But let's just make this very, very clear. Roughly 3-all in the second set, Federer like very obviously begins to change his serve. By the end of the second set, he's kind of sidearming it and just hitting slice everything. It seemed like the kicker wasn't really there for him.
No, he wasn't extending his shoulder.
No, I mean, at all.
I didn't watch the match, but I went back to look at the film, and his first serve at 3-all, he's already hurting.
Yeah.
Now, he might not – I don't know if it happened the game before that, which would have been presumably at the 2-all game, or what, right? But there's, you know, it seems like it's clear that there's something that's been building up over time. I mean, it's not like he, you know, fell on his shoulder or something in the middle of the match. Like, he was just playing, and then something clearly started to bother him pretty badly. And he did make a big change to his serve. So he basically didn't get to finish that match.
And there's a question whether it was his shoulder or his back. You know, it's good, especially given like his history with his back. I mean, it's possible that in that 2-all game, you know, he made a funny movement or something happened that kind of tweaked it a little bit. And he may have just been very conservative to not aggravate any injury.
Well, he definitely was conservative. He was holding back.
No doubt about that, obviously. But I'm just saying, like, there's a very – I mean, this is a guy, obviously, who's managed his career and injuries in a very – aggressive way in terms of his willingness to take a rest when he needs to and manage step away from the game. So we don't really yet know. It's hard to tell just from watching the match and his behavior in it how bad that really is yet. I mean, it could just be felt relatively minor and he just decided to be very conservative about it. Or it could be, I mean, he's, look, at this point, let's be real. I mean, we all know Fed would love to get back to number one, but he wants to win the US Open. He wants to win slams. He wants to spread the gap with the rest of the field. And he's not risking that for a Rogers Cup title. I know he would like to win the Rogers Cup. So, you know, he's never won it, but like he's not going to risk the US Open for it. So we'll wait over the next couple of days. I'm sure we'll find out more about that. But regardless, I mean, I think we have to take our hat off to Sasha for a great tournament. You know, he's obviously really consolidated and stepped up his game.
He's won 5 tournaments this year. I mean, he's playing well. The thing that really impresses me about him is that he's just beating all the people that he's supposed to beat.
Yeah, that's a big deal. Like it's we can't understate that. You know, that's one of the things. If we look at the Big Four, part of, I mean, part of the reason the Big Four got the results they have and have been so dominant for so long is because they go out and consistently, like day in day out, beat the people they're supposed to be. That's not easy to do.
No, it's really tough. And honestly, the only the guys that I think back to, like, okay, who was young? Like, who was like around 20, 20, 21, 22, and he's beating like everyone that's below him? And I'm thinking like Novak Djokovic, Rafael Nadal, Roger Federer. Yeah.
Well, Federer wasn't. Let's be real. I mean, at this age, Federer wasn't.
This is better. I threw in 2021, 22, just to, you know.
Yeah. Well, sure. So I'm still saying, you know, like, I mean, Fed were looking at 23 before he really starts to get things to click. But yeah, this is a very elite club that Zverev has played his way into now.
Yeah.
And you know, yeah, right. I mean, he's had some fantastic results this year. There's absolutely no doubt about it. I think we can legitimately, you know, call him obviously a very clearly a top 10 player.
He's playing. I mean, he's got 2000s this year. He's a top 5 player right now.
Crazy.
He's very clearly playing better than Nishikori and Rannick and.
Yeah, and no doubt about that. Look, this is great for the game. This is great for the game. We touched on this either the last podcast before that. This is such a fortunate time to be a fan of tennis when we have so many, you know, different generations that are actually active at a high level. There's so many stories taking place. We're getting upsets. But, you know, it's not upsets where, you know, like Shapovalov upsetting Nadal and then, Shapovalov didn't just come out the next. It wasn't a freak out of nowhere and then, you know, we look a year from now, Shapovalov's going to be playing, you know, challenges still. Like, this is...
No,
but we've had some of those in years past, right? I mean, if we look at some of the big upsets that have happened where some of the big guys have fallen to players. I mean, I'm always reminded of, I think it was Becker lost in the second round to, like, Peter Doohan, you know, and it's like, that's... Yeah,
good player.
Yeah, but let's...
Huge upset. Huge upset.
Yes, huge upset.
I don't think it was the second, but I could be wrong. I was before my time.
It was 87. I'm pretty sure it was either first or second round.
But look, I mean, the truth is, here's the thing. Like, Doohan was a good player, but Becker just didn't really play well that day, right? Like, when Sampras went out on court two early... Like, he didn't play well.
Right. Well, and also, to be clear here, we're talking about Peter Doohan won a single singles title in his entire career at Adelaide in 1984, right? He peaked at world number 43. So, you know, Doohan's not
He can play. He's got a singles title.
He can play, but he's not parlaying that win over Becker into... You know, I just jumped up the rankings a bunch and now I'm going to keep climbing and stick around. And we've seen, I mean, I don't want to like dwell on doing it too much, but we've seen upsets like that in the past. You know, like, I mean, Stakovsky's a good player, but, you know, it's not like his victory over Federer Wimbledon was this turning point.
No, and Stakovsky's still a guy who's still around, still on the tour. He's played a lot of matches as a veteran. And the thing that's really cool right now is if you're in the draw, or if, like me, you're coaching guys that are in the draw, you would much rather play Stakovsky than these young guys coming up.
Yeah, and that's my point, is really, if we look back over the last, you know, decade, basically, with the Big Four being so dominant, when they have been upset, by and large, the upsets, a lot of them have been shock upsets that didn't lead to anything. And now we're starting to see these upsets from players who actually have the potential, if not the inevitability, of sticking around at the top and making a genuine impact.
If you haven't been watching tennis lately, like maybe if you got a little bored or got a little away from it, start paying attention, because this is not the next generation in terms of, oh, here's the next group of guys that's going to be good.
Or that might be good, which we've been saying. We've been waiting a decade for this.
This is the next level of tennis. When you look at what, like the way that Shapovalov plays, when you look at the kid that's a year younger than him, Felix, and he's got an even tougher name to pronounce. We just call him Air Felix. When you look at the way he plays, I mean, these guys are complete players in a way that we have never seen before.
Well, I'm not going to necessarily agree with that. Because, you know, when I look at Nadal, I look at Federer, I mean, those guys are complete players. What I will say, though...
It's two guys.
Well, but I mean, you're saying, like, in a way that we've never seen before, and I don't think that's accurate. But what I will say is, what we're seeing now is, I think, a little bit of this reactionary evolution where, you know, tennis for the last 10 years has been dominated primarily, with the exception of Federer, whom risk manages very well, by primarily defensive players. And a lot of people don't like talking about Nadal as a defensive player, and I like talking about Djokovic as a defensive player. But that's just the reality. And what we're starting...
If Nadal wasn't defensive, he would not have lost to Shapovalov.
Well, this is true.
But no, I totally agree with you there.
Yeah, but my point is just kind of from a bigger picture philosophical level. You know, with the slowing of the surfaces, the slowing of the grass at Wimbledon, the slowing of the hard courts, the slowing of the balls. Like, what we have seen over the last decade is, you know, homogenization of the surfaces that has encouraged a level of defense that, you know, I mean, when we look at Djokovic, you know, I mean, his defense is absurd. His lateral movement, we've talked about this before. I mean, it's just, we've never seen anything like it before. What we're seeing now from this next generation, I think, is a little bit reactionary. We're starting to see some of these young guys come up who are really, like, aggressive players. And, you know, it's this whole question, like, you know, if the unstoppable force meets the immovable object. Well, now we're starting to see some unstoppable forces come up. And I'm really curious to see what level they can sustain offense at, you know, having grown up with, I think, a more balanced game than what we saw traditionally. You know, because when we look back at the more offensive players, if we go back 15 years, and even, you know, like over the last decade, you know, Federer's obviously got a very complete game, but a lot of these other guys, I mean, look at Del Potro's very offensive-minded player, but I don't know that I would say his game's terribly complete, in a sense. And you say that most of these guys that are very, like, that are aggressive players, they're not really complete aggressive players. Federer would be the only one that really comes to mind as an actually like a genuinely aggressive player who has a complete game. And now we're going to start to see this next generation who are coming up as aggressive-minded players with complete games. And I'm not saying they're going to go out and win 19 slams like Fed did. I think that's ridiculous. No, but...
I think there's going to be too much competition.
No, absolutely. But I think it's going to be fascinating. We're going to, like, this next, like, 2 or 3 years, while we still have Djokovic and Murray and Nadal playing great ball, and obviously Federer, but that's, you know... What we're going to start to see is we're going to bring back some of this contrast in styles at the actual top of the game that we haven't gotten to see as much of.
Yes, and look, most of that I'd agree with. The one thing I take issue with is about the slowing of the hard courts. I don't think they're as slow as people think they are. They're pretty quick. I think the big difference has been the training and the strength that the guys have. I mean, we have guys like Novak Djokovic is 6'3", like 6'3", like Safin was 6'4", and people were like, oh, he's huge, he's a power player, like,
sure,
he moves well for like a 6'4 guy. Like, there are guys that are like 6'4", 6'5", that are running around like they're rabbits.
No, I get you on that front. But look, I mean, but we do know the court. I mean, we have science that shows the courts are slow. Like, we've done, you know, this side-by-side, high-speed.
The grass is slowed down for sure.
Not just the grass, the hard courts have too.
Well, I'm just saying that I take issue with it. I'm not saying that you're wrong. I'm saying that I just don't know, okay? Like,
right.
I know that I said the same thing for years, and then when I got onto, like, center court in Melbourne and when I got onto center court here in Cincinnati, it surprised me how fast these courts are. They were much faster than I thought they were.
This is the other thing, though. This is the other piece of the puzzle is, in the last year or so, we've started to see some of the tournaments speed things up again. I love it. Like, I'm very happy about this. But I think we're starting to see the surfaces diverge a little bit more. We're starting to see some more variety. And I think that's going to help in terms of getting the young guys, you know, the opportunity to come out and play a little more aggressive tennis and be successful doing so. But, you know, like, we're really, if we go back and compare the hard courts from, let's say, 5 years ago to the hard courts from 15 years before that, I mean, there's a very big difference. And I'm just saying, like, there is. Like, we have, there's been some good work done on this. There is some pretty big difference. And I think it has really changed the dynamic of the sport. But I'm excited to see more variety coming back. I'm excited to see, you know, some more contrast in styles. As much as, you know, I admire the completeness of the top players now, and I think it's fantastic, there was also something about watching, you know, Andre Agassi play off against Pat Rafter, you know, where it is this guy who's just charging the net, like, point after point after point. Then you've got Agassi who's just, like, ripping returns and, you know, ripping passing shots. And that contrast is exciting to me in a way that watching, you know, Nadal and Djokovic run side to side for 5 hours just never quite was.
Look, you love the contrast. I love the mastery of the sport. This is the evolution of tennis that is happening right now and that we're watching. The guys that are coaching young guns like Shapovalov, like Air Felix, like Zverev, these are guys that are not 70 years old. These are guys that were around in the late 90s and the early 2000s and that understand attacking tennis. And it's probably never going to change that if you're 14, 15, 16 years old and you're playing international junior tennis, if you are an athlete and you can run around a lot and not make any errors, you're going to win a lot of matches. But these coaches now are really encouraging and downright forcing these guys to develop more attacking games to prepare them for the pros. Mm-hmm. And so it's not happening on accident. I mean, Shapovalov talks about it, how he tries to finish at the net as much as he can. He enjoys playing doubles. He enjoys going for it. Like, this is the evolution of it. And what we're going to see, you know, with these kids 7 to 10 years from now, we're going to see a lot of guys, or at least a handful of guys, playing at a level that is going to surpass basically what we've been used to. I mean, that's the way tennis goes, right? Like, if we look at how Rafa and Roger and Murray and Djokovic played, I mean, it's much better than, you know, the guys that I grew up like loving, you know, Agassi and Sampras and McEnroe and Connors. I mean, all those guys, like, there's no question that the level's gotten better. And the difference is going to be smaller, but the difference is going to be real.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I 100% agree with you that this is the next evolution. I mean, I've been waiting for this for a while to see some guys, because we have seen some aggressive players come through, but we haven't seen guys come through that are aggressive and complete, and aggressive and risk managing. You know what I mean? Like, one of the things when we watch Zverev play, I mean, he's playing with a maturity and a poise that obviously isn't just serving him well. I think is admirable for his age, but it's what we need to see from somebody who's going to come out and actually attack, you know, a more defensive minded player and be successful doing so and be able to come out and consistently get results. Because one of the things that we've seen with a lot of these attacking players is, look, if they come out and if you're attack minded and you don't have a complete game, well, you don't have a plan B anymore. And that's a problem. And so when you are a Zverev who can defend reasonably well, who can grind if you have to, when you come out and you're playing attacking tennis and something's off, well, you have the option to move to plan B or even plan C and figure out a different way to win. And that's one of the things that the top four have done such a great job of, and part of the reason why they've been so dominant is their ability to move to plans B and C and D and have more than one way to win a match if they need to. But
Okay, so I want to finish this up with one final question. We're going to make it about Sasha Zverev.
Okay.
If Sasha Zverev does not end up being a multiple Grand Slam champion, mm-hmm. what about his game will stop him?
That's a good question. I like that. So there's two things that to me stand out that I think will continue to clean up and improve. And I think actually in some senses already have started to. I wrote an article a little while back on his serve. And, you know, his serve is a bit spotty. He gets a lot of power, but he's not a spot server. Like, he doesn't hit his spots well. His precision is a little lacking. In addition to that, you know, he can be not just his precision, but I mean his percentages can be really up and down. For a guy as tall as he is, you know, his first serve percentage varies or can vary a lot match to match, and it can be way too low for a guy of his height at times. Mm-hmm. And like, so today, I mean, he served lights out. He absolutely nailed it on the serve, but you know, I think he has to continue to refine his serve and see his serve improve. I think he really needs to work on hitting his spots and maybe think about not necessarily backing off the swing speed a little bit, but just adding a tiny little bit more spin and really being able to control and serve with more precision. And I'm not talking about just today. Like, people don't get carried away and be like, oh my God, he served beautifully today. That's great. Like, he has matches where he serves great. He also has matches where he serves pretty poorly. What I'm talking about is just like day in, day out, you know, continuing to refine the serve. And then also, I feel the same way a little bit about the forehand. I don't. Yeah, there's just. I think it's just something about it. I haven't sat down and done like a full analysis on it yet. I will get to that at some point.
I'm gonna commission you to do a full analysis of his forehand because
there's something just small. When I look at him swing at the ball and the way he finishes, there's something in the finish that tells me there's something a little funky earlier on in the stroke, and I haven't sat down and looked at it yet. That makes me wanna. And I look, I'm holding this to a very high standard here. I'm not saying like,
oh come on, the guy's already a top five player.
Yeah, I'm talking about the difference between having a very good forehand and having like a Roger Federer forehand. I mean, like we're talking about
top five, or he wins like more than five slams.
He's top five, and his forehand is a big part of why he's there. I'm just saying, like, there's just something a little bit funky. And again, I haven't sat down and looked at it the way that I need to talk about this in detail, but I just feel like there's something a little off there that I think will continue to improve. I mean, like, the kid's working on his game. There's no doubt about that. We're seeing him. I mean, we've watched him improve in the last 12 months, noticeably. So, you know.
He gets better every 6 weeks.
The other big question to me is he going to really develop, like, a genuine feel at the net? Like, I think he's a reasonably decent net player. Like, he's not.
Now I think you're onto it. This is what I point to is – two things. One is that it is going to be the serve thing. I think he's not a good enough server. I think he's not a smart enough server. And I think because he's so big and so powerful that it's a little bit like Del Potro, that it actually will discourage him from becoming a really smart server. And I think that's a problem if you want to win multiple slams. Del Po, obviously, he got the US Open, but that's it. And don't cry to me about injuries. Those things are all related. And then the second thing is, I think he's got this general philosophy that he's basically going to power through people. He just doesn't spread the court enough. And part of that is the net game. He doesn't like to finish at the net. When he does finish at the net, he likes to put away easy volleys. He doesn't angle stuff off enough. And I would think that he could learn a lot from his brother here.
Absolutely. But the thing to me is, I mean, net play at the professional level, or really at any level, is to me one of these skills that just takes time. I mean, you really have to not just put the hours in practicing, but you have to put the time in at the net in matches that count, because it's a different energy, it's a different feeling than winning points from the baseline. And
speed.
Yeah, and so it's, you know, it's one of these things. If you go back and you look at the, you know, in the 90s and early 2000s, I mean, like, there was a long history of a lot of, like, the genuine true serve volleyers really hit their best in their, you know, mid to late 20s. Whereas, you know, a lot of times, like, the counter-punching baseliner types would hit their peaks earlier than that. And it's just because, I mean, I think that the volume of volleys is lower. If you just look at it from a sheer number of balls hit perspective in matches, you know, if I'm serving volleying, I'm hitting one, maybe two volleys a point on average. And if I'm a baseliner, I'm hitting, you know, 5 or 10 ground strokes per point on average. And that's just the volume in a match is very, very different. So I think it just takes longer to accrue the experience. And so I'm curious, you know, I think if he works at it, his net game will improve. But I don't think we'll really see it come to fruition for probably another 2, 3, 4 years from now. Whereas, you know, I'm not saying we're not going to see it improve. I think we will. But if he does the work, I still think we're not going to see it really come together for several years. But he'll continue to, I think, just improve everything else in the meanwhile.
Well, if he could volley as well as his brother, he'd be darn near unstoppable. So,
yeah,
I think that'd be pretty cool.
That's a fair statement. I mean, it'd be great to see.
We've said a lot of interesting things today, so...
Hopefully please. Interesting. We've said a lot of things that we think are interesting today.
Thomas, you've said some interesting things. I know I'm probably going to email you about some of them. So if I've said anything interesting or wrong, please email me, jacob@tacticaltennis.com.
And if I've said anything interesting or wrong or right, either way, love to hear from you folks. It's always good to get emails. Glenn@tacticaltennis.com. You know, we should hopefully be able to get one out next week. I'm flying up to Philadelphia to play National Grass Courts, and I don't know where the heck you're going to be, but...
I'm prepping for U.S. Open qualies.
Yeah, so hopefully we'll be able to get another one in and do a little bit of a preview and have an idea of what's going on with Fed and be able to talk about that some next time. But in the meanwhile, you know, jump by the website and sign up if you haven't already for email. Check your spam if you do, and have a great afternoon or evening or morning.
Wherever it is, wherever you are. Thanks,
guys. Have a good day. Yeah. Bye.
Bye-bye.